The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already at Friday. Hard to believe. Another fast-moving week nearly behind us. Of course, we've got another trumpet brief to come out later today. And on this this day, we pack that full of articles that have been posted at thetrumpet.com over the course of the week. So you can look forward to that later on today, as well as Trumpet Hour, that plays every Friday afternoon at 4 p.m. Oklahoma time, and at various other times around the world. I won't figure out all of the different time zones, but that's the Trumpet Hour with many of the contributors to the articles that you see at thetrumpet.com. On today's program here on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, we're going to hopefully spend a little bit of time at the end of the show on some feedback that continues to come in from those trumpet briefs. We'll update you on the number of new subscribers that we've added over the past week, and also update you on many of the literature requests that continue to come in as a result of those daily briefs. On today's show, we also will have what I believe will be our first ever movie review. You don't get those very often on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and for good reason. But this one is possibly perhaps the best exception that we have to that general rule. Stay tuned for that. Coming up in the second segment, we'll, as I say, be reviewing a movie that's due to come out in June of this year. Well, yesterday, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, he gave a speech in which he expressed, some of it was tongue-in-cheek, I think quite obviously, but he expressed some outrage at the United States, particularly the Trump administration, for supporting Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. And Mr. Trump, I think, even made statements suggesting that others should follow course. But here's what the European Commission president had to say yesterday. It's delivered in his native tongue, so you can hear the translator speaking over that. Clip one.
So Brexit isn't the end. A lot of people would like it that way. Even people on another continent, where the newly elected U.S. president was happy that the Brexit was taking place and has asked other countries to do the same. And if he goes on like that, I am going to promote the independence of Ohio and Austin, Texas, in the United States of America. It's business as usual in Europe. We must continue. We must forge ahead.
Now, obviously, as I say, he was, as many have said since, he was kidding about that. But still, it came in the middle of a fairly serious speech. And for someone, a European leader, I mean, you can, again, just imagine the kind of criticism that President Trump would get over that kind of a statement. But this is Europe's response, or at least Juncker's response to the Trump administration. And it just, as Andrew Miller is going to be writing about at the Trumpet, I don't think we have it posted just yet. But he draws attention to what we've been saying, really, for decades. This Atlantic rift, as Ron Fraser said years ago in one of his articles on this growing divide between the United States and Europe. In the forthcoming article by Andrew Miller, he refers to a piece my father wrote back in 2014 in which my father said Bible prophecy warns that a German-led European empire is going to rise up. And so we're seeing that happen. And my father went on to say, we have said that for over 50 years, it would probably be more powerful than both America and Russia. It says here, the age of American global leadership is drawing to a close. While the Germans might not come out and say so, they are reveling in that fact. Okay, we touched on this yesterday with respect to Brexit. While they may not come out and say so, there are many that are reveling in the fact that the United States and Britain are on the way down and out. My father said in 2014, the U.S. may try to repair relations with its former lover, but irreversible damage has already been done. The breakup, which started, he's referring in this 2014 article to the National Security Agency spying scandal. That's from 2014. Now, you just add to that, this is before Trump ever came along. And now you have Donald Trump singing praises for Brexit. And suggesting others should follow course. This divide continues. It continues. It's worsening. As my father said in 2014, notice this. The breakup is going to continue to worsen until one of America's greatest allies since World War II becomes once again its greatest enemy. Once again, it's going to become our greatest enemy. We've thought since the end of World War II that Germany's been one of our biggest allies. Well, history is about to repeat itself. History is repeating itself. There's another piece here, switching over to the Middle East. You might recall in one of my recent programs, I encouraged you to just get a map, or at least to have one nearby. Of course, with a computer, you can have one really nearby at all times. But with respect to what's happening in the Middle East, I mean, it's pretty important to be able to peruse a map on occasion to just get a good idea of strategy of what Iran is up to, the King of the South, or as we'll discuss here in just a minute, too, the Russian strategy. You can really begin to get an idea of that, as one article brings out, when you just look at a map. And that's what my father has encouraged us to do. Get a map when we talk about the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf or these critical passageways and what's going on in them and around them. And see what's happening. For one here, this is from Agency France Press. It says here, this is about Yemen. Houthis threatening strategic strait. That's the warning coming from another U.S. general. This article says Houthi rebels in Yemen are threatening free movement into and out of the Red Sea with missiles, mines, and other sophisticated defenses on a key strait. This according to a top U.S. general. And of course, they're referring to the Bab el-Mandeb Strait that connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. A critical passageway, a strategic one for world trade. It says here, acting with the support of Iran. Okay, so we know this. That's a well-established fact, even though it was denied initially or the involvement was sort of downplayed initially. But now everyone acknowledges they're behind. Iran is behind the Houthi rebels. Acting with the support of Iran, the rebels have deployed coastal defense missiles, radar systems, mines, and explosive boats that have been migrated from the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. Central Command Chief General Joe Vogel said or told the House Armed Services Committee. And it says here, finally, the installations threaten commerce and ships and our security operations in the area. This is his testimony. And he says, I'm extraordinarily concerned about another contested maritime choke point in the region. They're all being contested. Same with the Persian Gulf, Strait of Hormuz, same with the Bab el-Mandeb. So many of these passageways, these strategic passages, they're being hotly contested now. Another piece here from the Washington Post. Here again, you look on a map and you see Ethiopia right there pushing up against Eritrea and Djibouti. And then, of course, it's right off the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. The Post says here today, Ethiopia's parliament voted unanimously Thursday, this is just from yesterday, to extend the country's state of emergency for another 4 months. So Ethiopia is in a state of emergency right now. And this is Africa's second most populous nation. And it's really the regional power, certainly there around the Horn of Africa. And it's in a state of emergency. It goes on and discusses some of the things that led up to this point. I'll skip over that, but it says here, Ethiopia is a close U.S. ally in the fight against extremism in the unstable Horn of Africa region and has also become a magnet for foreign investment. And it says that Ethiopia, it says later in the article, Ethiopia blames Eritrea as well as Egypt for this unrest, for this stability. My father's had a lot to say about Ethiopia and Libya, along with Libya, just because of that prophecy in Daniel 11, those last few verses, verses 42 and 43, I think it is. But how that they're both prophesied to come under the influence or even the control of the King of the South, Iran. That's why they're subdued in the King of the North victory. That's a reference to that prophecy in Daniel 11, when the King of the North comes against the King of the South like a whirlwind. These nations will be subdued. It's a huge prophecy. And as my father has said, I mean, it may look unlikely, given that it's supposedly one of America's allies in the region. But we better believe the Bible. Believe what God has to say. And then my father says here, again, speaking of maps, he says, all you need to do is get a good map of the Middle East with the emphasis on the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. Okay, that's what we're talking about, the Red Sea here. Then you can see why the King of the South, or Radical Islam, is so interested in an alliance with or control over these two countries. Libya and Ethiopia, that is. They are the two seas that comprise the most important trade route in the world. That's speaking of the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. Whoever heavily influences or controls Ethiopia will undoubtedly also control the small areas of Eritrea and Djibouti on the Red Sea coastline. These areas only recently became independent of Ethiopia. Also, my father says, also I believe the Bible view is that these small areas are included as part of Ethiopia. I mean, you can't just look at the most recent drawing of the boundaries and say, well, this is where this nation exactly fits into these prophecies. In fact, Ethiopia is biblical Ethiopia is probably a fair bit bigger than what you see on the map today. Nevertheless, where it is on the map today, it's still helpful, and getting that map out is still helpful. The Bible identifies these nations. I mean, you look at, we've talked a lot of late about Djibouti and the bases that are being built there by the Chinese and others. Eritrea is causing some of the unrest, as Ethiopia has claimed. And all this, they're all together, and they're prophesied to fall under the heavy influence or control of the King of the South. That's what your Bible says in Daniel 11. So we haven't seen, not yet anyway, the Muslim uprising there yet. But the seeds are being planted. And here they are today in a state of emergency. It's building. It's building. The King of the South is putting together its kingdom. It's putting together its alliance with the other nations it's prophesied to be together with. That's going on right alongside the Red Sea, right around the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. And then just a bit further north, getting into Egypt and Gaza. Dan Shapiro had a piece at Bloomberg. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Israel. And he's saying that everything's pointing to the fact that there's going to be another war in Gaza. The next war is coming, he says. He says, well, he talks a little bit about his history as ambassador for 5 years. We were constantly preventing, managing, or responding to crises, he writes, trying to head off terror attacks by Hamas and others, supporting Israel's right to defend itself, negotiating ceasefires, and working to alleviate human suffering. I also learned that Gaza wars follow a kind of a routine. And he goes on to explain how that Hamas upgrades its attack capabilities. We've got an article at thetrumpet.com. I think it's in the second slot right now about this upgrade in its attack capabilities. You know, taking advantage of the pause in relations, or rather the pause in hostilities, I should say, to rebuild its arsenal. He says here, they try to avoid the escalation, but then Israel finally responds because the rate of rockets fired into Israel it's unbearable. And so Israel strikes back, and then you have a full-scale conflict. He talks in this piece about the new leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, how he's considered a harder line leader. And then says, finally, the Trump administration's surprising enthusiasm for promoting regional peace talks could easily create an incentive for Hamas, fearful of being left behind if Israelis and Arabs start to negotiate, to demonstrate its relevance and its ability to impose a veto on regional peace processes. So we could be coming closer and closer. I know Brent Noctegal has been keeping an eye on this and even discussing it on the radio here. But it's certainly something to follow closely. This man speaks from some bit of experience, and he's seeing the cycle repeat itself. A couple of pieces here about Russia before we break. This first one from Deutsche Welle talks about Russia's hypersonic missile and how that it could basically neutralize some of America's and Britain's most powerful naval vessels. Reports suggest Russia is preparing to test a hypersonic missile that would be almost impossible to intercept. It's called the Zircon rocket, capable of traveling up to 6 times the speed of sound. It says here, if the new anti-ship technology succeeds, Zircon will be able to cover a distance of 250 kilometers in just 2.5 minutes, so fast as to make it almost immune to interception by conventional technology. Several UK newspapers reported on Zircon's development in recent days, warning that it would make even the most sophisticated U.S. and British warships, including aircraft carriers, more vulnerable to attack. And it goes on to talk about some of the things that Britain is constructing even now. And, of course, the trend for both Britain and the United States has been to downsize and to hollow out the militaries. But in the cases where they actually are building up their arsenals, well, this missile, traveling this fast, it may make those new weapons, it may neutralize them altogether. It says here, last year, a report by the U.S. National Academies of Science concluded that America was falling behind Russia and China in the hypersonic weapons race. That's from Deutsche Welle. And one last one here, again, referring back to the map and to strategy. It's from the EU Observer. Russia building an arc of iron around Europe. An arc of iron. And what this article does is it just goes through the flashpoints and points to a map. This geostrategy, the grand game as it calls it, says the new arc of iron has seen Russia reopen Soviet-era bases in the high north and redouble military forces in its Kaliningrad enclave in the Baltic. So you have all the activities going on in the Arctic, which we've talked about before. Then there's Kaliningrad. there in the northern reaches of Europe. Three years ago, it seized Crimea from Ukraine. It's built up its military presence in the Black Sea. It says here it's reinforced its naval base in Syria. Brent Noctegal said a lot about that. It's agreed to share a new naval facility in Djibouti with China. Russia has. That's right there by the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. It's cultivating close ties with Egypt and with a Libyan warlord. It's starting to meddle in Libya now. We know about what it's doing in Syria and the base that it's built there. This article says, if you look at the Russian naval bases, in particular the joint base with China, Europe is in a way surrounded on its eastern side and on its southern side. You look at the map and then think about how Europe is going to respond. And put this together in relation to all the other events with Brexit, as we discussed yesterday. And then this rift, this Atlantic rift between the United States and Europe. Really, all that we're waiting for to bring it all together prophetically is that Daniel 8 man and for that European power to be whittled down to its prophesied size, 10 nations. 10 Kings. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll get into our first ever movie review. Stay with us.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Coinciding with the Normandy invasion this June, the anniversary of the Normandy invasion back in there toward the end of World War II, there's a new movie coming out about Winston Churchill and D-Day, and I believe it goes by the title of Churchill. And judging by the 2-minute trailer, you would think the movie is just packed with suspense, excitement, excellent acting, and so on, music. We'll let you take a listen to it yourself and see what you think. Here's the trailer for the new Churchill movie coming out in June.
We defy Hitler.
It is time to win
this great war.
For 5 long years, we have asked our men to endure the tribulations of war.
General Eisenhower.
Winston.
General Montgomery.
Mr. Churchill.
What a gathering.
If Hitler were to drop a bomb on this little patch, he would destroy the entire high command of our Allied forces.
We are here to make the greatest decision of our lives.
The invasion of France, taking the German army head on.
I've seen this before.
250,000 men were cut down at Gallipoli.
We must spread the risk.
The plans for D-Day have been in place for over a month.
I don't want to make the same mistake.
The forces are not carrying out your plans.
We're taking care of it. You need to let us do the job.
I beg your pardon.
I am the Prime Minister of this country, and I shall not be stopped from speaking my mind.
You can't just change everything over the heads of our allies.
Don't assume you're the only one capable of making decisions.
I need your help.
Try acting like a hero, Winston, and then maybe people will believe that you are one.
Men will die.
That's enough! My fiancé is on one of those ships. I'm sorry. I have no right.
You have every right.
He's not the man he was. He could be a liability as a leader.
Would you have us do nothing with the Nazis massing 20 miles off our shores?
No! I would have us do more!
This magnificent effort of air, land, and sea.
We must launch now.
He has to address the nation tomorrow.
Either to tell them we're winning the war or we've just killed thousands of people. Whatever happens, we must give them hope.
When it's all over, what will I be?
You'll always be the man who led us through this.
Our troops will fight on,
and we shall never surrender.
That's the trailer for the new Churchill movie coming out in June, and it recounts the week running up to the Battle of Normandy, D-Day, 6th of June, 1944. Well, there's this article by Andrew Roberts. He's a World War II historian, has written a number of books about Winston Churchill. And here's what he has to say about this new movie. He says, Churchill is well acted and has very good photography and music. It concentrates on Churchill's opposition to the operation, the D-Day operation, that is, on the grounds of the numbers of deaths it would involve, and attempts an insight into Churchill's psychology at that crucial stage of the Second World War. Robert says the only problem with the movie, written by historian Alex von Tunzelman, is that it gets absolutely everything wrong. And then he says, never in the course of movie making have so many specious errors been made in so long a film by so few writers. The major error of fact, of course, is that although Churchill did indeed oppose an over-hasty return of Allied forces to Northwest France in 1942 and 1943, by the time of D-Day in 1944, he was completely committed to the operation. And so, and you can even hear it in the trailer, 2 minutes worth. As exciting as it sounds, Churchill is made to seem like he was totally against it. He didn't want it to happen. Robert says here, indeed, in the final briefing for senior officers on 15 May, General John Kennedy noted in his diary how Churchill spoke in a robust. This is a historian actually referring to history. This is Roberts, the historian, his take, based upon what people actually said and wrote. General John Kennedy noted in his diary how Churchill spoke in a robust and even humorous style and concluded with a moving expression of his hopes and good wishes, urging offensive leadership and stressing the ardor for battle, which he believed the men felt. I mean, the men were preparing and he was backing it and supporting it. Robert says here, in this movie, however, Churchill is instead shown shouting at his generals, his wife, and secretaries, sweeping food plates and cutlery off the breakfast table onto the floor, and even praying to God on his knees, all because he wants to stop Operation Overlord, but had been overruled by a cabal composed of Generals Dwight Eisenhower, Bernard Montgomery, and Alan Brooke, who despise him. That's the story told in the movie. But it's not the actual history. Robert says, if Miss von Tunzelman had more than a passing understanding of British military-civilian relations, or indeed the British Constitution, she would know that as both Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, Churchill had the ultimate power over deciding whether Operation Overlord should go ahead, unless this film is attempting to claim that There was a military coup in Britain in 1944. Well, Roberts goes on to talk about the anti-American statements Churchill supposedly made, which again goes against everything that you know about Winston Churchill, whose mother was American, who talked on and on about the special relationship. It says here, Churchill is presented as a petulant, ill-tempered, sarcastic, unpleasant, decrepit, oafish, drunken has-been who was trying to disrupt the war effort and who violently opposed the campaign that was ultimately to liberate Europe, and so therefore was totally wrong on almost the single most important military decision of the war. This is what they're trying to tell a story about. How he was wrong about the single most important military decision of the war. And it's a deception that Dr. Goebbels would have been delighted with, but it flies full in the face of every single account left by those around Churchill at that transcendental time in world history. He is shown shouting at his secretary on the 3rd of June, 1944, for example, the very day that his actual secretary wrote in her diary, "He looked anxious, but he was amiable." That's the actual secretary's account of the day that's represented in this movie, or it represents him as shouting at her. And the movie says one thing, and the actual diary from the same day says the exact opposite. They make it out to be like his marriage with Clementine is about to end. She slaps him in the face at one point. Even has her bags packed. She's going to take off. They're going to get divorced. They're going to split up. And of course, everything you know, if you've read anything about Churchill, suggests that this was an unbelievably happy marriage. You just don't see marriages like that today. In real life, Roberts says, as opposed to in Miss von Tunzelmann's perverse fantasy, on 5 of June or June 5th, Clementine wrote to her husband a note saying, "I feel so much for you at this agonizing moment." This is in the movie. This is around the time she's about to pack her bags and leave. In fact, she wrote to her husband and said, "I feel so much for you at this agonizing moment, so full of suspense." Was she really contemplating divorce at this time? Or is that just Hollywood? Is that just Hollywood trying to denigrate this man? Sadly, for such a funny man as Churchill, there's no hint of humor in the entire film. Nothing. You think of the zinger of a quote, I read it earlier. How's he presented? Petulant, ill-tempered, sarcastic, unpleasant, decrepit, oafish, drunken. It says here, in this sad and pathetic caricature of the great events of June 1944, we see General Montgomery calling Churchill illegitimate, calling him that to his face, accusing him of doubt, dithering, and treachery. The Prime Minister isn't even shown the detailed plans for D-Day until the 3rd of June. Whereas, in fact, he had known them for months, Roberts says. He had known them for months. And yet these Hollywood filmmakers, they carry on this sharp division between Churchill and Eisenhower, Montgomery, and so on, right up until June 3rd. It says Churchill is then depicted as attempting to change the plans at the last minute to include attacks on Bordeaux and in Italy. He's depicted as being sarcastic and dismissive towards Field Marshal Jan Christian Smuts, a man he greatly admired, and saying, "We shall never surrender," in 1944, when there was no question of Britain surrendering. rather than in 1940, when there was a question of Britain surrendering. That's when he made the famous statement. He said it in 1940 when so many in Britain wanted to surrender. And he said, we're not going to surrender. We'll never surrender. That's what makes that such a courageous statement to make. In 1944, Britain was giving no thought about surrender. It was about to storm the beaches at Normandy and overtake Europe again. Churchill works lying on his back on the floor, then sits quietly at the back of meetings that in real life he chaired loquaciously. He's just kind of, in the movie, he's just kind of in the background. He's weirdly laying on the floor doing his work, not really participating in meetings. Old and decrepit. Eisenhower shouts at Churchill, "You, sir, must be stopped." Robert says that would have led to an international incident if it actually happened. Absolutely not one of these things I've listed, Robert says, ever took place. There was a moment when I wondered whether the whole movie wasn't, in fact, a sophisticated comedy satirizing bad war films, rather than, in fact, being by far the worst war film I have ever seen. And he goes on and says, you know, look, all movies take liberties with the truth. But this is not taking a few liberties with the truth. This is fraudulent. And it's set up in a way where you're going in because of what's said at the beginning and at the end, thinking that this whole drama is factual. It's true. This is what happened. One is prompted to ask why Miss von Tunzelmann, that's the one who wrote the movie, did not just tell the true story about a man and a military operation that was packed with genuine drama, excitement, and courage of such an extraordinary order that it would command universal attention, instead of producing this tripe that can only bring universal derision. I mean, the story itself, the true story, it's packed with drama and excitement and courage. But Hollywood won't tell that story. Hollywood wants to tell a different story. Why? He says, finally, when this film states of Churchill at the end, he's often acclaimed as the greatest Briton of all time, it seems clear that its makers want the audience's reaction to be, but he can't be great because he got D-Day so badly wrong, this moronic old drunk. Robert says, it's a foul slander, and I suspect they know it. Well, you better believe they know it. It's a foul slander. I remember, this was about 20 years ago, visiting the Churchill War Rooms down in London, just being absolutely shocked as I was buying a few souvenirs on the way out at the attendant at the cash register, just going on about how horrible of a leader Winston Churchill was. We were in the Winston Churchill War Rooms. And in this man's view, he was horrible for Britain. Same with these movie makers, evidently. I haven't seen it. I'm going on what this historian has to say. And he's a reputable historian, Andrew Roberts. Richard Palmer was telling me about some of the books that he's written on Churchill and on the World War II era just this morning. But notice what Robert says here. There's a sense of profound decadence in any society that dishonors its greatest heroes. If this movie is anything but a terrible flop, ours will fully deserve its decline and fall. Those are strong words there from Andrew Roberts right there at the end of his piece. If this movie is anything but a terrible flop, we deserve our decline and fall. We deserve it. I mentioned a few weeks back this biography by William Manchester, how much I had been enjoying it. I think I got about a third of the way through, and then I set it aside. There's just quite a few things to read up on and to prepare for, getting ready for Passover and the days of unleavened bread. But after reading this review and seeing the trailer of this new movie, it does make me want to get right back into that book and reread the history and see what Churchill himself said and his aides, his secretaries, and those around him. To know the actual history, so many valuable lessons to take away from it. My father has his own little booklet on Winston S. Churchill. It'd be good to pull that off the shelf and to be reminded of the courage of this man who in 1940, when quite a few in Britain were seriously contemplating surrender to Hitler, he said, "We are never going to surrender." He said it during Britain's darkest hour. And so why won't people just tell the true story itself, which is packed with suspense, filled with excitement, loaded with courage? Obviously, there's a valuable lesson in this. All throughout the Bible, learning from history. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10 that all these things in the Old Testament, they're recorded there for our benefit, our learning. They're for us. It's so that we might not make the same mistakes they made in the wilderness. Paul said again in Hebrews 4, don't commit the sin of unbelief like your forefathers did in the wilderness. To get out there to follow God and then to forget, to not believe, to not walk by faith. Notice what Moses said to the people of Israel. This is in Deuteronomy 4, verse 1. He says, "Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the eternal God of your fathers gives you." Hearken to these words. I mean, listen and learn. Don't add to this your own ideas or thoughts. He goes on to say in verse 2, don't tamper with these inspired texts. Don't rewrite the script. Verse 2, you shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Don't take away, don't add to it. Just stay with it. Stick to the script. God says, I've given you the script. It's right there in front of you. I've inspired it. And yet, what has been man's nature? What has been man's history? He loves to revise the script. He loves to tell a fairy tale. He loves to say something about a historical period that's not even the truth. Well, maybe Winston Churchill really wasn't the greatest Briton in history. Maybe he really wasn't that great of a leader. Maybe he really didn't know so much. Maybe those who wrote about him, like Andrew Roberts and William Manchester, and so many others, maybe they were exaggerating some of the accomplishments. I've got a new story to tell. And this one is about someone that was more of a petulant fellow, ill-tempered, sarcastic, unpleasant to be around, decrepit, a drunk, a has-been, He didn't even support D-Day. What does God have to say about the lesson of history? Verse 5 of Deuteronomy 4, "Behold, I've taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, and you should that you should do so in the land where you go to possess it. Keep, therefore, and do them," God says. "For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' For what nation is there so great who has God so near unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law, which I set before you this day? Follow this law," Moses told them. "Stick to the script. And if you do, you're going to be the envy of the nations." I mean, this is the kind of story, going back to the movie, I mean, where if you actually, if you told the true record of history, other nations would look at this and say, "Wow, what a story. I wouldn't mind following that script." Moses said to ancient Israel, "You'll be the envy of the world." People, other nations would be really impressed by what it is that you've accomplished. He said, "Only take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, lest you depart from your heart, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. But teach them to your sons and to your sons' sons." Here we are now, some of the sons of the sons who fought in World War II, or the grandsons. Now they're being told this story, this history. And so many of them don't read it to begin with. And so here comes the movie. And movie makers who would say, "Well, it doesn't really cause that much damage. I mean, after all, he was a little bit against going in there too prematurely in 1942 anyway. So we just kind of extended that to 1944 to suggest that he was against D-Day from all the way through to the end. What's the big deal? Everybody does it. Everybody does it." Moses says, "Especially the day that you stood before the..." Well, again, Moses is just telling them to remember their relationship with God. Remember these covenants. Remember these commandments. Remember when you came and stood near the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire. Remember when God spoke to you out of the midst of the fire and declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments, and he wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. Stick to that script. In the former prophet's book, my father quotes a historian who said this about Winston Churchill, his writings. He said, "Churchill's reading of history reinforced his early education to exalt the heroic virtues. He was Roman rather than Greek, and as he admired Roman accomplishments in law, government, empire, so he rejoiced in Roman virtues of order, justice, fortitude, resoluteness, magnanimity. These were British virtues too. And because he was the very symbol of John Bull, Churchillian, he cherished as a law of history the principle that a people who flout these virtues is doomed to decay and disillusion, and that a people who respect them will prosper and survive." Well, but you're not going to learn about that in the new Churchill movie. You've got to read about it in the former prophets and elsewhere. My father went on to point out, learning lessons from great leaders of the past is critical to our national well-being. If we flout those heroic virtues of history, our nations are doomed to decay and disillusion. But if we respect and emulate them, we'll prosper and survive. He says, this is a law of history. Our national survival is at stake. You see, it does matter. It does matter how we retell the history, how we retell the story. Our national survival's at stake. I mean, we're talking about a law of history. Use this movie, as I want to do now. Use it as incentive to get into, in my case, Manchester's biography. There's plenty of other ones by Martin Gilbert and this author here, Andrew Roberts. Make that your summer Churchill. Your summer Churchill movie, just to plan ahead for the month of June. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll update you on some statistics, and with whatever time we have left, get into some feedback. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
The response that we keep getting to these Trumpet Brief emails, it's just been tremendous. Over the past week, we've had 130 requests for literature. I think I mentioned on last Friday's program that we had more than 100 come in. Most of these requests for literature are just people subscribing to the Trumpet magazine as a result of these short little emails that go out each day. This week, 130 requests, and numbered among them, we had 38 people request Germany's conquest of the Balkans. If you recall, on Monday's program here, we talked about what my father had said back in 1999, following all that was happening there in the 1990s, Germany behind the breakup of Yugoslavia. And then I forget the National Interest, this article from just last weekend, that basically summarized so much of what's in that booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. And we drew attention to it then again in the brief on Monday. And since that Trumpet brief went out, 38 people have requested that booklet to go through it. Pretty amazing. Over the course of the week, too, we added another 135 subscribers, new subscribers, to the Trumpet brief. So this follows, I think, 240 in the first week, and then 203 last week, and then 135 this week. So it's been a little bit of a tapering off there, but still some really good numbers for over the last 3 weeks. New people subscribing to the Daily Trumpet Brief. And then the feedback coming in from these emails going out. This one here, keep up the excellent reporting and honest interpretation of world events coupled with the Word of God in prophecy. That's from California. Another one here says, yes, you've come a long way. That's in response to one of the emails where we talked about that. I used to watch Mr. Armstrong on TV and read The Plain Truth and his books, etc. Modern technology now plays a huge part in your work. Another one here, it says, thank you for the Trumpet magazine. All the articles are written carefully and very easy. They're very easy to understand. Another one here says, I believe the time is coming that the Trumpet will be placed right in the middle of a media frenzy. Someone will scoff at the information, and there will be a look at the truths that you've presented. It says, we're prepared for the attention that will come. This one here says, thank you so much for God's wonderful work. I must say, I love the radio station. I listen to the latest programs and also go back through and listen again to older programs. And if I think I didn't get it, I keep on listening until it finally sinks in. I'm not the best reader, it says, so the radio is fantastic for people like me. I can put my earphones in at work and be filled with God's truth. This is such a blessing. I'm so excited about what's happening in the world right now. Christ is going to return in our time. It's mind-blowing. So happy and blessed to be part of this work. Well, I have more, but I just ran out of time today, so maybe I can tuck a few of these away for next week. But keep those comments coming in. If you'd like to comment, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm or just respond to your daily brief. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you next week.